The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Fun, the For Us Network.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
Hello and welcome to Suck It to Politics. I'm Ed DeSuck. Joining me today, Hafiz Noorani. Hello, Hafiz.
Hi, Ed. How you doing, man?
You have to say hello, hello, or I think you've been replaced by an imposter.
Oh, hold on. Let me bring it on, Hafiz. Hello, hello.
There we go. Thank you very much. Now I don't care if you are an imposter, as long as I can claim that I thought you were real.
You're among us.
We'll have to wait and see what the level of your commentary. If it's really elevated, we'll know it isn't you. Aaron Seale is joining us. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, hello, everyone. Pleasure to be here.
Wait a minute. Now you're doing hello, hello. Are you guys screwing with me?
A little bit, yes.
All right. Well, today's the day to do it because I've been, you know, it's a side effect of the fall. You know, I'm just, the days are gray. It's like, the day doesn't look like it ever got out of bed. And I don't feel like I should have got out of bed today. I've been dragging my ass all day. This is the thing about the fall. Everybody, like, oh, the fall, the colors, screw all that. The fall is the season of death.
I think Canada could benefit from like a new national holiday that we have across the country. And it's called just like Nap Week. And it's this time of year. It's before everything starts with Christmas and whatnot. And you have it just before Halloween. So, you know, the parents can get ready for Halloween and all that other stuff. And we just all chill the fuck out and just all nap. And the whole country just quietly shuts down. We go shopping for everything before for food and whatnot. And we just chill. We all communicate on like TikTok or something.
You know what? They do that in Spain. It's very civilized. Been dealing with some people in Spain on a project, and they come in, they do their work in the morning, they have lunch, they go home and have a nap. They come back like an hour later, and then they work until they've made it an 8-hour day. But it's civilized. They have themselves lunch, they have a little nap, and science has found that actually balances the circadian rhythms better. That's why you always feel like, even though you feel peppy and shit in the morning, around 3 o'clock, you're like, oh, fuck, is this day ever going to end? That's because your body needs a nap at that time. And if you give people a nap, they wind up waking up refreshed and being more productive instead of crawling to the finish line of 5 o'clock every day.
They do that in India, too. Like, my mom used to be able to come home and have a nap and then go back to work. Obviously, they also worked a lot longer hours there. So, but it balanced out.
I think any place that it's really hot, you know, there's siestas in Mexico.
Yeah.
The day is just the middle of the day is just so hot. If you don't have air conditioning, it's not really much to do. And of course, traditionally, they didn't have air conditioning until it was invented. So it's like what George Costanza did on Seinfeld when he made that little place inside his desk where he could lie down for naps. I think that's civilized. How about you, Aaron? You big on naps or no?
Well, my favorite high school math teacher once a year gave us nap time in class. And that's one of the most glorious memories of my high school days. And you were absolutely right. She almost had this pulse. She would invoke it in the very day where the class needed it. And it absolutely worked. It got us all concentrated. And for me, we talk about entrepreneurship on this show from time to time. In my mind, one of the greatest benefits of entrepreneurship is the lifestyle flexibility. The ability to say, yeah, I'm just not having a good day. So I'm going to put off my work and I'll get to it when I'm in a position to do it better. In my mind, that's healthy. And if you're listening, if you're plotting out your future, there's a lot of people right now whose lives are changing. I would recommend entrepreneurship for a variety of reasons, including the ability to control your schedule.
You just have to have a good idea and be willing to work like a dog to do it, because you might get a chance to nap. But the rest of the time, you put in way more hours as an entrepreneur than you would as an employee.
You and a clue right in reality, sure.
And a clue in reality. A lot of entrepreneurs start up a lot of things without looking at a market and seeing whether or not that idea would work.
I'm going to go into the pickle business. It's like, but there's already lots of people selling pickles. Yes, that must mean they are popular. Yeah, that's not the kind of logic you go into. I don't know why the hell I picked pickles. I told you, my brain's barely working today. All right, so... which reminds me that I don't even remember what the topics were. I think
the
first topic...
Well, pickles links logically to Max Bernier, so let's talk about the by-elections.
All right, thank you very much for that segue. I don't understand it, but unless You say that Maxime Bernier is frequently
He's in a pickle because, like, this whole People's Party of Canada has been kind of a shit show, to say the least.
Well, they can hold their membership meetings in a phone booth. I mean, there's no mandate for People's Party. They should just start calling it a few people's party, because that's really all that it is. I mean, what did he get in a by-election where there was something like 15,000 votes cast or something like that?
642.
642. Barely anything.
Well, the thing is, like, it's a by-election. And when you're looking at by-election results, the first thing you got to look at is voter turnout. In York Centre, the voter turnout was 26%. In Toronto Centre, the voter turnout was 31%. Normally, we're talking in the 50 to 60 range recently. So when you're in those 20 and 30% numbers, you're talking entirely ground game. It's a question of how many voters and which voters can you get out to the polls, because most people are going to be indifferent. A lot of us, when we were looking at these results on the night of the by-election in York Centre, we were kind of cheering for the narrative that those 642 votes or whatever Max would end up with would turn out to be the difference between the Liberals and Conservatives. In fact, the Liberal candidate pulled away from the pack a little bit, ended up with 46%, which in a by-election is a reasonably strong showing. The Conservative in York Centre got 42. But the question is, going forward, Maxime Bernier, with his People Party, 2% of the electorate, or however much it was last time, will that be enough next time around to swing ridings that might otherwise go Conservative? If you talk to PPCers about that, they'll get very defensive about it, saying they're independent, saying you don't control our votes, saying the Conservatives shouldn't feel entitled to our support. And from an individual perspective, for any individual supporter of the PPC, they're absolutely right. Nobody is beholden to one political loyalty over another. If any individual voter feels a desire to support the PPC or to support Max Bernier, more power to them. But if you're looking at the Conservative side of the political spectrum writ large, and if you're trying to engineer a Conservative government because you believe that fiscal restraint is necessary in this moment, then you have to be looking at the PPC with a little bit of a raised eyebrow, because that size of support, 640 votes for a candidate like Maxime Bernier, that can often be enough to swing ridings, and that may well be enough going forward to give Justin Trudeau the support he needs to survive next time he goes into a general election.
I don't know. I think that part of the reason Bernier got that is people saw PPC and they thought they were voting for PPE. They thought they were voting to give that Maxime Bernier was supportive of giving people personal protective equipment.
Well, I'll give you this.
He's against masks.
The PPC brand is largely worthless. Maxime Bernier is running on himself. And if you look at his history, a man that can come second as close as he did to Andrew Scheer, this is a man who's shown that he's able to drum up electoral support.
But in Toronto Centre, I mean, come on. Like, who was voting in Toronto Centre for Maxime Bernier? I mean, the Liberals got 10,000 people. You think there's 10,000 people in Toronto Centre who think Maxime Bernier is the best choice to lead Canada or even their riding? I think if Maxime Bernier wants to win a riding, he should run somewhere in like Northern Alberta, Northern British Columbia, basically. And maybe even Northern Ontario, somewhere where there's people that, you know, don't like masks, immigrants, gay people, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, the thing is, he was running in York Center, not Toronto Center. York Center has a huge population of people who were immigrants. There's a large voting block there who were immigrants or children of immigrants. So he's really running uphill in that. What were you going to say, Aaron?
Well, the thing about Maxime Bernier's fate is it's going to be decided in the Beauce. His riding, his home riding, the same riding his father represented at the federal level, is in northeastern Quebec. It's the riding that he held during the Harper years, and he's going to run again. And he has a phenomenal bedrock of personal support there. He was competitive last time around. Like, it was not guaranteed that he was going to lose in the Beauce. And in fact, he probably thought he was going to win. Now, his strategy, where he's running a little bit all over the place, York Centre this time, whatever the next by-election might be, he loses nothing by presenting himself in these random places across the country when the opportunity arises. And for the PPC, it's not clear that there's anyone else in his league in terms of name recognition and political abilities. The only one last time around who was even on the radar was Renata Ford in Etobicoke, who didn't do especially well, but at least got her name out there. For Maxime Bernier and the People's Party, if there's a by-election, it's not clear to me that there's anyone else that they would want to put up other than Max. But as you say, Hafiz, like, it's not clear that regionally he has a shot at success anywhere other than his home riding. So in my mind, what he's doing by presenting himself is, one, maintaining his place in the political dialogue, in the narrative, because every time he runs, people are going to listen to him. He's going to get news media attention that will help him down the road. And beyond the fact, you look at those 642 voters that stood behind him in York Center. If any of them donate to him, or if any of them mobilize ground support for him, that's a win for him. He doesn't have to win at the ballot box now to reinforce his standing for the future. The question in my mind is, when the opportunity comes for him to present in Beauce where he belongs, how will he do next time? That, for me, is the big question.
So it's a long game.
Exactly.
I don't know. You know, I think that if Bernier was to get elected, I wouldn't be surprised if he crossed the floor and joined the Conservatives.
Oh, I don't think, knowing him, and he and I go back, he sat on Treasury Board when I was Tony Clement's Director of Policy, when Tony was President of the Treasury Board. I've briefed him personally. In his mind, like, his place for me is sitting next to Jody Wilson-Raybould as sort of the right side conscience of the political spectrum. I don't think he has any desire to reaffiliate with a larger party for the same reasons that we saw after he was booted at Foreign Affairs. He relished the independence that he had, being able to write whatever he wanted on the blog without having to feel beholden to a partisan position. He wants to be able to voice his opinion in raw form, and he'll be held accountable for it. I would be very surprised if he chooses to take a major party affiliation, just like I'd be surprised if Jody Wilson-Raybould did the same thing. She had an opportunity. She was invited by Elizabeth May to take over the Green Party, and she chose to protect her independence.
But it's a Green Party. You were talking about major political parties.
Yeah, yeah. Like, who wants a piece of lettuce? Like, Jody Wilson-Raybould is like half the Green Party's current seat count, isn't it? Like she's not going to get a party that's going to take her far. She's going to have much more of her voice, being her own self, and the other fact of the matter is, she's a little bit more conservative than the Green Party is.
Well, also, that's the interesting thing. You're absolutely right. Jody Wilson-Raybould is a complete wild card. I'd actually like to see her run for the leadership of the Liberal Party personally, but that's just me speaking for myself.
I'd love to see her too, so I can see her get slaughtered.
I think it'd be fun for all involved, if nothing else. But as you said earlier, Hafiz, with a lot of this stuff, you got to be really careful trying to make political mountains out of molehills like by-elections. As you were saying, Hafiz, it's a long game for Maxime Bernier. It's a long game for all involved. If you look at the Toronto Centre results, Anna Meepal, the new Green Party leader, got 33% of the vote in Toronto Centre, which is a fascinating result, because the Green Party has never been competitive in Toronto Centre before. Now, the thing about Anna Meepal is she brings a brand of her own to the Green Party, based on her political values, based on her personal story. And if she can get 33% of the vote in Toronto Centre this time around, it'll be fascinating to see if she chooses to run there next time, if she can build on that base, because that's not nothing. 33% is sizable, and it's a great place for her to work for, to make inroads in a riding that the Green Party, in my view, would not have considered before.
By-elections are a report card on the incumbent. That's what I usually find. And it's usually elections where people that are most against the current government party show up and cast their ballot. The fact, though, is over 10,000 people showed up to vote for the Liberals. The governing party in Toronto Centre was really, really powerful. And I think what that really just goes to show how many people are out there that I really appreciate everything the Trudeau Liberals have done for them, despite all the
noise that the other parties raise.
Well, Hippies, the nuance is that the Bill Morneau, the former MP of Toronto Centre, was very powerful on the national basis and even on an international basis. But locally, you can make a very clear argument that he was negligent. And Toronto Centre is a very interesting riding because it's a contrast between some of the richest parts of Toronto, the Rosedale, Yorkdale area, or Yorkville areas, and some of the poorest parts of Toronto, the Moss Park and the Regent Parks. So it's not, and I lived in Toronto Centre for 5 years. It's not clear to me that Bill Morneau on a local level was a representative that cared about local issues. And if Annamie Paul chooses to put down political roots there, taking on questions like homelessness, like mental health care, housing, medical health and medical support, these types of local issues, very similar to how Elizabeth May put down roots in Sandwich Green Islands, can provide her the base of support that can win her a riding that would not be accessible on a brand level alone. So it'll be very interesting to see whether she chooses to build on her support, Ms. Paul does, or whether she chooses to move to a riding that has historically leaned more green.
You know what? You're wrong. Because, well, you're right that she could put down roots if she wants. This is a by-election. She did well in a by-election. The fact that so many people turned out to bother voting for the Liberals in a by-election says something about the strength of the brand there. Because in by-elections, people don't feel there's anything at stake. All right? So if they're largely satisfied with the government of the day, they just generally don't show up because they don't feel there's anything at stake.
When you are there is right something about that.
When there's something at stake, right. They'll show up. The Liberals will show up in greater numbers, and I think you'll see her proportion of the vote drop.
The question for her going forward is, tactically, can she harness the power of what she has created in the by-election? There are people, 33% of those who showed up to vote chose to vote for her. So the question for her is, can she maintain their support? Can she draw on them for ground game strength, for door knocking, for fundraising? And can she build on that support in a manner that, I agree, Ed, is not always the case. There's a lot of people who do well in by-elections and you never hear from them again. But Annamie Paul now has a job ahead of her. She's not done. She has to be out there reinforcing support, talking to people, building relationships. That's what's going to win her the riding if she can succeed, and that's entirely in her hands.
All right. Aaron, what was the next topic?
Well, we've talked about the two by-elections, so let's go national. Let's talk about Michelle Rempel-Gardner and Patty Hajdu with respect to COVID response.
The masks, and who's better at all of this, getting caught with or without a mask and sort of response to COVID protocols. I think it's really hypocritical that Michelle Rempel, of all people, is holding Patty Hajdu in account for not wearing a mask at a restaurant because Michelle Rempel didn't even isolate for the full 14 days before returning.
Well, also taking a picture of somebody without a mask when they're eating, nobody wears masks when they're eating. Because it makes it difficult for the food to get through the membrane of a mask.
Althea Raj said on Twitter that she was told by someone, I think on some train service, that she has to, after you take each bite, you put your mask back on. That's just fucking stupid. You're going to get your mask dirty with food.
You can't eat with a mask on. I don't know who you are. Even Spider-Man peels his mask up when he wants to eat something. So taking a picture as a gotcha, that's like saying so-and-so had their pants down in public and it turns out they were in a bathroom stall.
Agree with you gentlemen that you can't really expect there to never be an instance of a questionable photo because as you say, if people are going to eat, they're going to have to take off their mask. And Patty Hajdu's response to the photo was, I was eating, that there was food. It wasn't in the photo. And if you can't see it, it's really tough to judge. The bigger issue is the narrative. Because if you are the Minister of Health in the time of a pandemic, you've really got to hold yourself to a high standard. And if even the possibility of that picture is being taken, if you are in that position of authority, you've got to be conscious of that. So I agree that you shouldn't blow this out of proportion. But I think it is something that Michelle Rempel-Gardner was right to call out. Now, the bigger question that matters isn't about personal conduct. It's about policy. And we've talked before, and we've written on the FU Network website about how Pierre Poilievre's gambit to try to reignite the Wii scandal went nowhere. And I think the three of us are in agreement that that's probably a good thing, because that was beating a dead horse. Michelle Rempel-Gardner's tactic is trying to put together a proper COVID oversight committee so that we can have confidence that there's democratic oversight over the Trudeau government's decisions with respect to pandemic response. Now, that in my mind is more reasonable than what PP was doing, because for a pandemic that's been going on for 6 months now and that doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon, I think it's reasonable to expect that elected parliamentarians will have some oversight and influence and scrutiny over the decisions of the governing party. And it's not clear to me that the Trudeau government is inviting the type of opposition oversight that is reasonable to expect in a healthy democracy. So I think Michelle Rempel-Gardner is doing better than Pierre Poilievre is in holding the government to account. The question in my mind is she going to be able to simultaneously criticize and supervise the elected government while positioning her party and Erin O'Toole's party as a government in waiting? And that's the piece that is missing in my mind, because you hear these gotcha moments over personal conduct and you hear cries from the opposition for documents and for transparency. But in my mind, there isn't an alternative being presented yet. To an extent, that's reasonable, because Erin O'Toole still hasn't been leading for very long. You shouldn't judge him on the record that he inherited. But at some point, the Conservatives are going to have to promote something proactively rather than just responding. And in my mind, I'm waiting with bated breath for that.
Listen, I would agree with you that it's reasonable to have this, to have an oversight committee, to have a committee that doesn't really interfere with the government's ability to handle the pandemic in rapid fashion, but one that takes a look at how does the government done, what did they do right, what did they do wrong, if they did something wrong, why was it done wrong, was it because there wasn't enough information available, so the decision in hindsight was wrong, but at the time was right, because this, I don't care what anybody thinks, this is not the last pandemic we're going to be facing. There's going to be more of them, and I just hope they're not worse than this one. So we need to take lessons this time. I mean, we learned some things from SARS. We were a little better prepared because of SARS, because we had that protocol in place. Hopefully for the next pandemic, we'll have learned something from this pandemic. And I think it's important to have a government panel that examines that in an objective way that best suits the needs and interests of Canadians. I just don't think that's the goal of this committee. I think the goal of this committee is to embarrass the government and say, ha ha, look where you went wrong before. Ha ha, you didn't do this right. We would have done it better.
I'm with you on this, because I in another world where you have an opposition that's actually earnest and isn't just looking for gotcha moments and trying to play politics on every issue, I would understand where you have a situation where there's shared oversight and there's a real emergency like a response to things. I think because of this pandemic is an unseen thing, and because you don't see the people that are affected by it, they're in some hospital, that they're allowed to get away with this. And I mean, if this was a war that we were in, or if this was a major environmental disaster, like a post-earthquake situation, can you imagine if the opposition tried to play those type of games?
Well, the war comparison in my mind is the right one. And the political oversight mechanism that we end up with should, in my mind, mirror what we would do in wartime.
Exactly.
And in those situations, opposition parties do come together and with government in bounded settings with very clear norms about what gets broadcasted and what gets shared and what the timelines are. But whatever the institutional norms that the committee comes up with decides on matters less than the ability to have an institution in which opposition parties can get the information they need to hold the government to account in a reasonable manner. And the longer this goes on with Justin Trudeau choosing to use press conferences and private settings rather than parliament as his means of conveying information, distancing himself from oversight from opposition parties. In my mind, the longer this goes on, the less tolerance there's going to be from the public for that type of high-mindedness. We still live in a democracy despite the pandemic, and there is still there's still value and there's still importance in giving opposition parties the right to be heard and the right to information. So in my mind, this is on Trudeau. He's gotten the latitude that he's needed over the last 6 months to respond in a coordinated fashion, but opposition matters and democracy matters. And if Trudeau doesn't respect that, I think that's going to be held against him.
Well, again, democracy does matter. I just hope that the opposition parties care less about their electoral fortunes and more about the fortunes of Canadians, because that hasn't been what we've been seeing. And it's disappointing. Completely.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They if this was something where you saw actual things coming out from the opposition that the government could do to improve the lives of Canadians, like when Jagmeet Singh said that, hey, no, Mr. Trudeau, you should maintain CERB the same way as it was before, that was a positive thing. But if you look at everything else, it's been positioned as a political gain, trying to push the narrative so that they can have an election. But you know what? This time their bluff was called. I don't know if you can really put this all on Trudeau, because at the end of the day, he has the bully pulpit. He has the right as a leader of the country to speak directly to the people of the country during an emergency situation and tell them exactly what's going on. And you know what? This is Canada had years of Stephen Harper where they never saw their prime minister speak to them on any national media channel. And they'd only hear about what Canada is doing on an international network. For once, we have a leader that's looking us in the eye through the camera lens and telling us, this is why I'm doing something. And this is in your interest. I think when you start to see the other parties play that in an earnest fashion and not just for gotcha moments, you'll see them start to succeed more.
Yeah, with Aaron O'Toole, I'm growing a little concerned that his focus is a little too inward among the conservative base than I'm comfortable with. And there's one line that he's taken to using in a couple of settings, which is an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. He's invoked this with China. He invoked it with France today. And it ties to the mission statement that he outlined in his first speech to caucus, which is from adversity, the stars. Now, these quotes sound good in the abstract, but if you position them with the recent history of the Conservative Party and the Conservative Caucus, remember that they've just come out of a period of about 6 months of a bitter leadership race that came on the heels of Andrew Scheer's performance, which was criticized loudly both during the election, especially afterwards. So it seems like there's an insecurity within the Conservative Party and a desire to reinforce the base, which in my mind, the way it's coming out is not really the type of thing that you would expect for a party that's looking to broaden its support. If all you're just doing is preaching to the converted, you're going to end up exactly where you are. So in my mind, the pivot that's needed from Aaron O'Toole is away from the types of messaging and tactics that won him the leadership towards the type of messaging that will create a big conservative tent that will realistically, that can realistically lead to a government. And I haven't seen that yet. Now, granted, it hasn't been very long, but that's what I'm waiting to see, the type of messaging and the types of positions that will broaden conservative support rather than just play to existing supporters.
Good place to end that topic. And what's next on our dance card, Aaron? Sorry, I'm relying on you, but I can't get my brain in here.
Well, we were talking about Trudeau's positioning. We've talked about conservative position. We've talked about the health file. But the question is Trudeau's gambits on confidence vote. He stared down Pierre Poilievre. Now he's been more open with respect to Michelle Rempel Gardner's COVID advocacy. But the question is, does Trudeau want an election? And it seems to me, based on what he's doing, whether or not it's strategically wise, he's prepared to take the John Horgan approach, as Premier Horgan did in British Columbia successfully, and say, look, if you want to call me out on anything, I'm going to take it to the voters. And John Horgan showed that it can be a successful strategy. Andrew Wilkinson, as you both were alluding to, tried to play the brand card with the BC Liberals without a whole lot of substance backing it up. And it came back to haunt him because the BC electorate showed that they were reasonably satisfied with the performance that the NDP government was doing, and they weren't willing to change things on the basis of ideology and party brand alone. And Andrew Wilkinson, on a personal level, didn't bring a whole lot to the table. So the question is Justin Trudeau willing to do the same thing? And it seems like he is. And if he is, how will the opposition parties react? Because just creating these gotcha moments and forcing and creating confidence votes that they're not going to win, it's not a good look for the opposition.
Well, it reminds me of those. I mean, it's not politically correct to cite those stories anymore, but the old stories of Uncle Remus and Brer Rabbit and Brer Bear, and Brer Rabbit saying, "Don't throw me in the briar patch, Brer Bear. Don't throw me in the briar patch," which is exactly where he wants to go. And I think that that's exactly what Trudeau wants. He's saying, don't make me call an election. Don't make me call an election. But he definitely, I mean, the Liberals are at a high watermark. They can, they're not going to increase much from here as far as support. They could decrease. So if I'm him, yeah, I want an election. And I want an election that I can sell to the public as one I was forced into, so that the opposition gets punished for an election that nobody wants to have, and the incumbents, the Liberals, benefit from being high in the polls. I mean, from a political calculation, that's where I would want to be. Hafiz?
You know what? He is playing a very, very smart game here, because even with how the last thing happened where with the new budget and everything post-CERB, post-break over there, he made it look like it was on Jagmeet Singh holding everything up. And even with this last call out that they had on him, he played it to the end. And, you know, he called the opposition's bluff. And what it really comes out to show is that it's all about the theatrics for Jagmeet Singh and Erin O'Toole. And both the Conservatives and the NDP aren't really thinking about Canadians in a time when Canadians are most worried about their future. And the Liberals get to come across as looking like adults, and adults get rewarded. That's what happened with Stephen Harper the last time around when he won his election, in a situation where he was in a minority. Even though he was in charge of the government, he came across more as the adult party, and the opposition at the time, the Liberals and the NDP, were playing games, and they got stepped on by Canada and the electorate.
Hafiz, I'm with you in the sense that I think Justin Trudeau is playing his political cards quite smartly, given the situation he's in. And in my mind, it's up to the opposition parties to change the narrative. In my mind, the CPC needs to set down some sort of a policy position that gives them strength. And one option that comes to mind for me is just saying, we can't afford this. The magnitude of deficit spending, combined with the magnitude of growth in the money supply to facilitate it, because whether or not it's directly or indirectly, let's be honest, the Bank of Canada is, and under Tiff Macklem's leadership, is supporting Trudeau's deficits through increases in the money supply. And the consequences of that are going to play out over time. And it's not clear that economic theory is prepared to define with authority what the consequences of this fiscal and monetary expansion is going to be. And in my mind, some of the fears, inflation is an obvious one. If you're increasing the money supply to the extent that Tiff Macklem is doing, that money's got to go somewhere. The debt fund, the ability of the government to finance its continued deficits in the form of debt over time may well change as financial markets react to the magnitude of deficit spending. There may well be tax consequences, and inevitably, at some point in the long run, we're going to have to pay for this stuff. And the economic decline that we're seeing as businesses are closing, as gyms are closing, as restaurants are closing, like, we can see visually, if you walk down the streets of any of the downtown cores, these shuttered storefronts that were thriving a year ago. That has consequences on families. That has consequences on people. So whatever the line is, we can't afford this could be one, but somewhere along the way, the opposition is going to have to carve out a position that Canadians, that will resonate with Canadians, and these gotcha moments Just don't do it for me.
You know what? This whole the whole idea of we can't afford this. Well, the question then is, well, what do we do? We can't afford it. What do? We allow people to starve. We allow people to default on their rents, to lose their homes. We allow people to have to decide between rent and food. Like there needs to be more than we can't afford it. There needs to be, here's what we can afford. And
well,
something
I will say,
that will support people.
There was a very interesting op-ed by a guy named Sean Spear, who I know very well. He's also a former director of policy of Flaherty in the National Post, who focused on the word growth over the weekend, saying, where have conservatives lost the concept of growth? And I'll give a shout out to him saying he's absolutely right, because if I think of Flaherty's budgets towards the end, his title was Jobs and Growth. And that's fundamentally important, because you're right, Steve, we can't just leave people to die economically. We can't just say, oh, we're not going to pay the bills, so tough luck, so sad, find your way out of this. Conservatives need to be promoting a realistic plan for economic recovery that includes incentives for job creation, incentives for entrepreneurship, incentives for scientific innovation, whether they be fiscal or otherwise. And it's up to them to reason that out. As we were saying earlier, concept of a government in waiting. If you say that we can't afford the current plan, you've got to promote a better one. And that's up to Aaron O'Toole personally.
I would agree with Aaron to a degree on this, because I think they could reinvent the game on what their messaging is. Because since Stephen Harper lost the election, the conservatives still haven't gotten over one thing, and that's Justin Trudeau. Their policy and their entire platform cannot be anti-Trudeau. This is not the USA where you could run on I'm not Obama and win. This is Canada. You need something a little bit more to win this election. And what conservatives also need to realize is when they say we can't afford this, that message is going to fall short on Canadians in 2020, because Canadians don't look at the budget the way they used to 10 years ago, especially after we've been through things like the Afghan war and whatnot. And the amount of money that we've thrown with a blank check at things like that, Canadians wonder, well, why can't you afford this, which is putting money back into us and just keeping the engine of the economy oiled up so that people are still spending on the things that they need to. Now, based on this pandemic, I think the other major issue that the Liberals have failed on, that they really should focus on, is say, you know what, let's shut everything down. Let's get rid of COVID. Let's do this for 4 weeks and let that be it. And then once it's all gone, let's all just go back to life as normal. Because currently what you're seeing out of the conservative policy is still giving room to this whole concept that this is not as serious as it is. Own the pandemic and own it by saying you're going to do a better job and then just get us all back to normal.
100% agree.
Though I disagree that I don't think that shutting everything down for 4 weeks is going to kill COVID. It'll drop the numbers substantially for 4 weeks and for 2 weeks afterwards, but it'll still, but the numbers, the virus is still there. Once we start going back out, then the numbers will climb again.
We'll make it 6 weeks then. Like, and what's
staggering? It doesn't matter. 6 weeks, that means 8 weeks later, we're going to have the numbers go back up.
We got to look at countries like what Taiwan and Korea did, because we need to trace where these things are. And then get to a point where in those 4 weeks, we have tested so many people that have had it and figured out through contact tracing where they got it, and then isolate only those people left that are still infected while you let the rest of the economy open up. And guess what? In six weeks to 8 weeks, now we've got a situation where we're no longer a threat to each other and we can go back to living a normal life like they're doing right now in Taiwan and South Korea.
Nah, it ain't gonna work here. That wouldn't work.
No. What do you mean it's not gonna work here?
The only
difference between us and the people in South Korea and Taiwan is that they don't have fucking idiots that believe in anti-mask bullshit and things like
Sure they do.
No. If you do that over there, you are treated like a fucking moron. The whole society.
Well, you're treated that way here too.
No. Over here, you can have a big group of support, and the media will be like, "Oh, but maybe they might be right." No, they do not.
I haven't seen any media that says maybe they're right. They always cover them as idiots.
they don't cover them fully as idiots. The whole way art society functions is it gives these people that are stupid some level of presence on the media. Now, over there, they don't even cover them. If you don't wear a mask, you get your ass kicked on the street by the rest of society. And that's just not even talked about.
The only way to that we could really possibly clamp this down is if every single person was tested, and that way we knew the people who were carrying it but were asymptomatic and who never actually demonstrate any symptoms at all but are carriers. Because otherwise, if we're only clamping down on the people who show signs, there's a whole number of people out there that are spreading it around that are going to wind up infecting people who are going to show symptoms.
In the 4 weeks that we shut down, in my hypothetical scenario, we test as many people as possible.
No, we have to test everybody.
You will not be able to test everyone in 4 weeks. It's just,
to your point, Fies, I think we have to have a richer conversation about the details of this stuff, because it seems to me that we're almost having the same type of discussion we were having 6 months ago about what COVID is and what it isn't. And that frustrates me, because we've got a lot of lived experience now that gives us insights that we didn't have at the start of this. Just today in Ontario, data was put out on the sources of outbreaks of COVID as we are now.
Weddings.
It's 39% schools and daycare, 33% long-term care and retirement homes, and just under 33% other. In my mind, that's valuable information, assuming it's true, because none of us created this data ourselves. But if the problem is localized in institutions, that requires a very different response than a total lockdown. And some of these smaller businesses, such as gyms, for example, are really crying foul, because these are the guys that have bent themselves over backwards, putting out cleansing measures and distancing measures, because they know how vulnerable their settings are. So they've taken action to cleanse their venues, and now they're just being shut down. It's as if they haven't done anything at all. These people are frustrated because in their minds, they did everything they were supposed to do to maintain the safety of their businesses, and they see no benefit for it. So in my mind, we as a society have to stop being deferential to what I'll call a scientific establishment. Just because someone calls themselves a scientist doesn't mean that their opinions resulting from their analysis necessarily flow into policy recommendations that should be accepted blindly. We as lay people need to dig into the analysis and have a detailed conversation so that we can craft plans that are more nuanced than just say, go into lockdown again for 4 weeks. That's going to destroy people's lives on an economic basis, on a social basis. And it's not clear at this point that it's the right policy response to the moment.
It's not just any scientist making these claims. These are scientists that are approved and accredited by the government and who the government takes advice from. It's not but Joe Blow, it's the advice. Scientist.
It's what? Advice. It's not conclusive fact, and it should be scrutinized. I agree that we should respect experience, credentials, wisdom, but it doesn't mean we should be blind.
It should be, but scrutinized by whom? Joe Schmo on the street should not be scrutinizing. It should be scrutinized by their peers. And this is what scientists do. The problem with what you see on the media is that anyone with the word doctor now is being allowed to give an opinion.
Exactly.
And the problem is there's certain specific fields that should be giving an opinion, and it should be the people that are actually dealing with COVID.
Anybody can give an opinion. There just shouldn't be any Joe Schmo that we listen to. But all right, listen, we've talked this out. It's a bigger topic and one for perhaps another day. I think that we've effectively gone through these topics for tonight. Tonight, today, whenever the hell you're listening to this thing, doesn't make any freaking difference. I want to thank you guys for the participation, and I want to thank Aaron for keeping us on the straight and narrow today, because I was lazy. I can't get off my ass today. So I want to thank you, Aaron, for keeping us on point and on topic.
Well, you're a sock puppet, and I don't think I've ever seen your ass, and I'm not entirely sure you have one. But hope you enjoyed your day sitting on it.
Would you like a snapshot?
No, I would not.
No, the Patreon. Put that on Patreon.
There actually is a picture online of me showing my ass to Avril Lavigne. So if you're really curious, you can go and type
it. All right, CBC. Let's make this frontline news. Add the socks ass. Well, this is what we need to add 2020 with.
Yeah, the ass picture is probably about a dozen years old. So I don't know that it's really news. But Hafiz Noorani, thank you as well for your contributions.
Oh, you're very welcome. I always enjoy these.
I thought you were going to say another word after these, but you stopped there.
I know it's rare that I have short statements to make.
Yeah, especially when there's an opportunity for a word to fit in there. Usually you fit in six.
I enjoy these podcasts, these get-togethers, these moments of joy with you gentlemen.
All right.
That, I miss our other hosts in the show right now that's, you know, working away there.
We should mention that Sam Eamon wasn't able to join us today because of when we moved the recording to. So we'll hear from her again.
I did my best to represent progressives, but, you know, I'm not very good at it.
So. All right. That's it. This has been Sock It to Politics. I'm Ed the Sock. Thank you for listening on Fun the FU Network.